We've been singing for the last couple of moments a song about the promises of God. You know, sometimes we overlook the promises of God and don't give enough attention to them. We're all interested in being happy and joyful, and I think that's something that we all can be if we really look to the right source. God has promised us eternal life in heaven with Him if we simply obey His commandments. He has promised to us a relative happiness in this world if we obey His commandments. And yet sometimes we, all of us, you and me, we overlook those promises of God. Sometimes we, as Christians, have to ask ourselves the question, why would a person who knows the gospel, who knows of all of these fantastic promises that God has made, why would that person who knows that, and in fact may believe it, fail to obey it? You know, there's some of you here today who have never obeyed the gospel to begin with. And you know the gospel. And I believe that many of you believe it. So I ask the question, why do you fail to obey it? Why would you, or I, knowing the promises of God of eternity with Him in heaven, something beyond the problems of this life, so fantastic that it's unimaginable, why, knowing that and believing that, would we fail to hold out our hand and try to take it? If you're not a Christian today, I want that question to stay in your mind throughout this lesson. But the lesson isn't directed solely to you, though you're the ones that are uppermost in my mind. But as we as Christians look at the same issue, why on our part as Christians, knowing the promises of God, would we fail to do some of the things that He's told us to do as Christians and imperil or perhaps take away those promises from our lives? If we have studied the Bible and we know of God's love, and we know how much He's concerned about everything turning out right for us, that He was so concerned that He would sacrifice His own Son in exchange for you and I, if we know that, and we know the promises and we know the judgments that are to come, why would we fail to act upon that promise? Sometimes I think we look upon God as some terrible person who's laying burdens upon us for some reason or the other. But in fact, God is trying to do just the opposite. The things of this world put the burdens upon us, and God's trying to take them off of our backs. Why, if we know that and believe it, would we not obey it? Well, you know, I sat down this end of this week in preparation of this lesson, and I asked myself that question. And then I asked myself that question about some of you that I know the gospel and believe the gospel. And I tried to find the answer to that. So what I did was I tried to take it for the moment out of the religious realm. Sometimes we try to divide our life into the religious and the temporal, and sometimes it gets confusing when we try to apply a religious standard to ordinary common sense. We sometimes mix it up. So I ask myself, why do we as humans very often in our lives fail to do what's good for us? You know, we do that all the time. Just let's forget the religious aspect of it for a moment. There's a lot of things that are good for us that we simply fail to follow through with. And why do we do that? Well, I think the answer is that we make excuses. And that's the key to my lesson this morning. I think we all, you and I, make excuses for not doing sometimes what we know is good for us. And that's why I believe that some of you who know the gospel and in fact believe it, have not done anything to obey it. I think you believe that there is a God. I think you believe that Jesus Christ died for your sins. I think you believe that there's going to be a judgment day in which the good and the evil are going to be parted, and that there's a heaven and a hell, and people are going to be divided. I think you believe that. I know you know it. Let's look at the nature of our excuses. What is an excuse? An excuse is an effort to free ourselves from blame. You know, we feel like we're not doing something that we ought to be doing, or we feel like we're doing something that's not quite right, and to explain it so that we can go on living without feeling too bad about ourselves, we make an excuse of some type or the other. An excuse is something that is given to minimize a fault. If we see a fault in our lives, then sometimes, oftentimes, we make excuses. I've done that, I still do it, and I bet every one of you in the audience does it too. When we see something that we don't particularly like about ourselves or the way we're doing things, we make an excuse for it. It's a way of defending our conduct and making us still feel good about ourselves, even if we know something isn't quite right in the way we're doing it or the way that we're living. We have all made excuses. You know, with four children, I've become an expert at excuses, at giving them and receiving them. Why isn't your bed made? We ask every morning. Because my brother didn't make his. We'll just get in it again tonight. On and on. Why haven't you taken a bath? Well, I wanted to watch TV. I haven't got time. On and on. And the best one is still, my brother didn't take one. Why haven't you brushed your teeth? On and on. But you know, kids aren't the only ones that make excuses, and they learn how to make excuses from you and I. That's what's frightening when you see your own excuses coming back to you to different questions, you know. Karen says, why haven't you got the yard mowed yet? Well, I've got something else to do. I'll get to it tomorrow. Or I ask her about cleaning the house. Now, we'll just kind of go right on over that. But and as Christians, we ask ourselves sometimes, why haven't I studied the Bible like I ought to have? And I say, well, I was busy with this or I was busy with that. The answer is we were watching the television, but we never answer that way. We give some other excuse for not having done it. And when we ask ourselves the question, why, as a Christian, haven't I been trying to teach someone the gospel, or why haven't I gone out and visited the sick this week? Again, we come up with all sorts of answers, none of which are exactly the truth. We're making excuses. We see something that we know we ought to have done, something that is good that we should have done, and we didn't do it, and we feel inwardly bad about that, and yet, for some reason, we're not quite ready to do it, and we make an excuse. An excuse usually trades a long-term good for a present personal desire. I know it's good to teach someone the gospel. I know that it's good to go visit someone who's sick, but right now, personally, what I want to see is 60 Minutes or some other thing on television, or I want to read this book that I've got before me. That's the truth to the issue, but usually we all make an excuse for why we haven't done it. The real truth of the matter is that usually we prefer recreation to work. We know the work ought to be done, and that in the long range, it's best for us to get the work done because it's going to be beneficial for us. But it's a lot more fun right now to do something recreational. We're exchanging a long-term good for a present personal desire. We're exchanging quick satisfaction for something that's going to take long-term effort. You know, I know that teaching someone the gospel isn't something that you go out and in the time that it's going to take to watch this hour television program, you're not going to be able to teach too many people the gospel in an hour. What I know is that it's going to take some commitment, and I'm going to have to do it today and next week and the next week after that, and I'm going to have to make some long-term commitment. And if I know that, and yet I'm not quite willing to do that, I may do something quite short-term that seems more pleasurable to me for the moment. And I'll make an excuse as to why I didn't do it. Another reason that we sometimes make excuses is to avoid something that's unpleasant or that is difficult to do. There are some things about being a Christian that are unpleasant. There are certain positions that you're going to have to take as a Christian that are going to leave you in an unpleasant situation with your co-workers or some of your friends. Some of the things that you're going to have to do as a Christian, that we are going to have to do as Christians, perhaps I ought to say, is going to be difficult to do. And I don't know about you, though I suspect that you're the same as I. When you have something difficult and unpleasant before you, you often make excuses to find a way to get out of doing it. We all seem to have that inclination. So, as Christians, we do that. And I think some of you here this morning who are not Christians, if you honestly consider what you believe and what you know, and ask yourself the question why you've never obeyed the gospel, I think you'll come to the conclusion, if you're honest, that you've been making excuses to yourself. The Bible is full of examples of people who made excuses for not doing what God told them to do. In Genesis 3 and verse 12, Adam and Eve had just been created. They had been given a paradise to live in. The closest thing to heaven that will ever exist upon this earth, Adam and Eve lived in. They had a place of perfection. They didn't have to work in the degree and to the nature that you and I do. They didn't have weeds in their garden, and they didn't have all of the problems of deterioration and everything crumbling about them that we have. They lived in the perfect environment that God created for them, and He made but one rule, not a Bible full of rules. He made but one rule that they had to live by, and that is that they couldn't eat of the fruit that was in the midst of the garden. But they did. When God confronted Adam with it, He didn't say, "I wanted to eat that fruit." He said, "The woman, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." He blamed somebody else for it. Now, how often have you and I done that? Those of you that aren't Christians, how many times have you blamed somebody else for the fact that you haven't become a Christian? "I don't like the preacher. I don't like the way some of the people at that congregation behave. Some of them are hypocrites." And you're right. But that's an excuse as far as your behavior is concerned. And what about the rest of us as Christians here? How many times haven't we done something that we are supposed to do, that I am supposed to do, and I've blamed somebody else for it? I've made an excuse, and I've shifted it over to them, just like Adam did when the world began. God told Moses that He wanted him to go before the Pharaoh of Egypt and speak the word of God to Pharaoh and bring about the release of God's people, Israel. The first thing Moses said is, "They will not believe me." You know, sometimes that's the same sort of thing that we say when someone asks you or me, "Why haven't you gone and taught somebody the gospel?" You say, "They won't believe me," or, "I don't know enough." Or like Moses fell back in his second response, he said, I am not eloquent, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. I can't talk well. God didn't accept that excuse, did he? He told him to take along his brother with him, get the job done. And a lot of us give that same kind of excuse for not doing something. I can't do this or I can't do that. Well, go get somebody that can help you and go do the job. We need to quit making excuses. When God has told us something to do that is good for us, that is beneficial for us, and when we weigh the promises that God has given us for doing it. You know, when you think about it, the few little things that God asks us to do in comparison to what he's offering us. Most all of us go to work someplace or the other, and we exchange 40 or 50 or however many hours we work in a week in exchange for some monetary reward. Or some of you that work on commission, you exchange your work for the commission you receive. And relatively speaking, we exchange something that is of about equal value to our employer for what they get in return. But God isn't talking about that. He is asking us not to do something that is terribly hard or that hurts us or that is damaging to us. He's telling us to do what's good for us in the beginning, in the first place. And he says that if we'll do that, he'll exchange to us everlasting life in heaven. Now you think about it a minute. What kind of excuse can you make for turning down a deal like that? If I were to offer one of you $1 million to walk from this table to that door, would you make excuses to me for not walking from here to that door? That's not a good comparison in one sense, but in another sense, the relativity of what God asked in terms of what he offers, maybe my comparison isn't so bad. If I were to ask you to do that, would you make excuses at every pew before you got to the door? Or would you run to the door? I know the answer to that. I don't think there's a person in here that would turn down $1 million or give me any question. You'd do it by faith and you'd get to the door, and whether you really had that much faith in my delivering it, most of you wouldn't have a whole lot of faith because you don't know, I don't have $1 million. But if I did have, I think you'd do it just to see if I would give you $1 million when you got to the door, without question, without excuse. And yet we know that God can deliver upon his promises, and we make excuses for not obeying him. Saul was sent to destroy Amalek and the Amalekites. He was told to destroy everything. And when he came back, Samuel met him, and he had Agag, the king of the Amalekites, in chains. And Samuel could hear the bleating of sheep and the lowing of oxen. And Samuel said, "What is this, Saul?" Saul was the commander-in-chief. He was the guy that gave the orders. But his answer was, "They have brought them, and for the people spared the best." He was the man in charge, but he said, "They did it. The people did it." He took and made an excuse for not doing what God told him to do. Felix in Acts 24, when he'd heard the gospel presented to him, and it made him tremble. It frightened him. It scared him. The power of the gospel was that strong. I believe he believed it. He knew it because Paul told it to him. He knew what God wanted him to do. And I think the fact that he trembled indicated that he believed it. And yet he said, "I'll wait for a more convenient season." There's also some indication that he was looking for a little bit of money from Paul too. But he knew the gospel, but something else kept him from acting, and he made an excuse. "I'll wait till a more convenient time." And then in Luke, the 14th chapter, we have the parable of the Great Supper. Jesus was trying to make a point there, exactly what I'm talking about this morning. The Great Supper is a description of God's invitation to you and I to come to the glories of heaven when we pass this world. In that parable, he tells of the first man who, when he was invited, he said, "I just bought a piece of ground and I have to go look at it." How many of us are going to exchange some real estate or an investment for heaven? Think about that a minute. If I own the whole city of Dayton and all of Beaver Creek and all of Xenia, in fact, I own the whole state of Ohio, if every bit of it was mine, would that be a fair trade for heaven? Another man in Jesus' parable said he couldn't come because he just bought a team of oxen and he had to go out and try them out. And the third man said he had just married a wife and he couldn't come. All of these are examples of things that, you know, we read the parable and it sounds ludicrous. You're invited to the Great Supper. You're invited to come into the kingdom of heaven and be a child of God, an heir of God, one to inherit the kingdom of heaven that's in heaven. And to make an excuse that I can't go because I have to deal with something here on earth. I have to talk to my wife. I have to go look at a piece of real estate. I have to go try out the oxen, the new car today. Turn down heaven for something like that. But you know, when we make excuses, when I make an excuse for not doing what I'm told by God and you make an excuse, is that not what we're doing? Trading something of inestimable value, I couldn't get that out very well, of extreme value for something that's petty and something that won't be here very long. In Romans, the first chapter, we're told a little bit of something about excuses too. In the first chapter, in verses 16 through 20, Paul told the church at Rome, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." You know, what is frightening about our excuses for not doing God's will is that everybody here today has access to this book. And this book describes what God wants us to do. And we have that before us and we can believe it. And when we stand in the judgment day, we're going to have to give an answer because we know what's in this book. What Paul told the Romans was, even a person who does not have this book is going to stand without excuse in the day of judgment, because the glory of God is manifested in the nature of the world around us. And we ought to be able to see his eternal power and Godhood in the very things of nature. But you and I are extremely without excuse because we know this. And furthermore, those of us who are Christians and some of us who are not, we believe it. And then if we don't do it, we are without excuse. Well, how do we cure ourselves of excuse making? Thought about that for a little while. And I think I'm better at finding the answer than I will be at putting it into practice, but I think I did find the answer. Any of you who are in some form of management or have heard this word till you're tired of hearing it. And I never thought I would use it because I'm sick of it in the business world. But that world is prioritize. Have you ever heard that word before? Prioritize. Decide what's most important and do it first. In the business world, we have to prioritize all of the time. There's 100 things that I need to do today, but I'll be lucky if I get 10 done. So what am I going to do? I need to prioritize and do the 10 most important things today and let the others go. We need to determine as Christians, and if you're not a Christian this morning, you need to make a decision to prioritize what's most important for your life. Turn with me, if you would, to Luke, the 14th chapter, beginning with verse 26. It says, "If a man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." That is an awfully difficult sounding verse or group of verses. But what Jesus is saying is that there are lower priorities in life than serving him. If you let parents, your wife or husband, your children, even your physical life stand in the way of serving God, then you've got your priorities askew. But you know, most of us are not making that sort of excuse. Most of us are not having to make the decision between our wife and serving God, or between our parents and serving God, or our children and serving God. Most of us are taking priorities that are much, much, much lower on the list, and we're letting them create excuses for us from obeying the gospel. Jesus was also making the point that if we let freedom from suffering, or if we let having fun take priority over serving him, then we're making a mistake. We're not prioritizing right. I'm struggling to try to find a way to express clearly enough the foolishness of that for each and every one of us. All I can do is say, imagine for a moment standing before the judgment of God and having a flashback over your life as God reviews your life. And he tells you or reminds you of the sacrifice that he made of his son and how he promised heaven to you if you'll be obedient. Take anything that you've been using for an excuse for not obeying the gospel and just imagine looking up into the eyes of the God of heaven and giving that excuse to him then. Can you imagine looking at God on that day and telling him, "I had other things to do. I had other things to do. Lord, I didn't obey you. I didn't count the blood of your son worth a thing because I had other things to do. I had things that I wanted to accomplish. I wanted a nice house and a nice car, and I needed to work Sundays to do that, or I needed not to go out and have to live like you asked me to live because I wanted to do that." You're looking through the gates into heaven, if you will, in a physical sense, and you see heaven there, and to your other side you see hell, and you look both ways. And you still look up at God and say, "I had other things I wanted to do." I don't think you'll be able to get the words out of your mouth in that day. I don't think I will be either if I make that kind of excuse. Beyond prioritizing, I think we get around excuse making by trying to plan for the future and not just all the time be looking at the present. If you'll remember, one of the things I said was a key to what an excuse is that too often we've got something right now that we want to do, and we decide to do it rather than doing something that is of more long-range value to us. It's kind of like when I was a kid, if I wanted a bicycle, and Dad said, well, I bought you your first one, you're going to have to buy your second. And I got a dollar or so a week that I got as an allowance. Well, I had a choice to make there. I could either go over to the little mom and pop grocery store around the corner, and I could buy the popsicle and the bubble gum that I wanted immediately and satisfy that desire, or I could put some of that money away and save it up till I had the bicycle, which was the long-term goal that I really had. Well, I got the bicycle in that day. And again, that's an oversimplified example, but we could very well, with our spiritual lives, squander away our hope of heaven for the equivalent of popsicles now. When we trade what we want to do right now, we take our time and our influence and our efforts and we squander it upon the simple things of this earth, we could be exchanging, and we will be exchanging, all of that for heaven. We need to plan for the future and not just the present. Esau sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. Adam and Eve traded paradise for a piece of fruit. Judas traded his life and his eternity for 30 pieces of silver. What about us? What will we trade for? What are we doing with our lives? You know, we have to ask ourselves that kind of question every day. Those of you that aren't a Christian, I said I'm talking to you this morning, pleading with you to answer that question. What are you doing? Why haven't you become a Christian? Let me just stop a minute. And every person that's here this morning who's not a Christian, you just pass it through your mind for a few moments. Tell yourself, why am I not a Christian? What possible reason? What possible excuse? And I'm speaking kindly to you. I'm not trying to be angry with you or speak unkindly to you. The only reason I'm up here this morning is to try to convince you that you might be making a mistake. No doubt you're making a mistake if you don't become a Christian. You say you don't know enough? I've heard people say that before. But you know, I look at the book of Acts, and I look at the people who responded to the gospel in virtually every one of those cases, and they didn't know a fraction of what most of you know. I know an account of a man who was an Ethiopian eunuch who was driving down the road in his chariot, reading the Bible, and he didn't understand what he was reading. Philip got in the chariot with him, and I don't know how far they went, but there's no indication that the trip lasted over a day. And by the time Philip was done teaching him, they came to water, and he said, "Here is water, what doth hinder me to be baptized?" And you look at example after example where people, when they first heard the gospel preached, they obeyed it. So I can't believe that you don't know enough. As kindly as I can, I believe you're making an excuse if you say you don't know enough. If you say, "I have things to do yet before I become a Christian," I want you to think about that. I'll believe that and I'll accept that. that might be your reason, but I want you to evaluate that. What is there? What possible thing is there that you could do that would be important enough to possibly pass up heaven for? Now, I know you're not thinking about it in those terms. You're thinking that someday I intend to become a Christian. But what if something happens between now and that mysterious time you plan to become a Christian? What if you lose it? What possible thing could there be that you want to do that would be worth trading for heaven? And you know, you might tell me, and a couple of you have, that someday you plan to be a Christian. That's good. But I think, as I've mentioned before, I wonder what it would be like if that day didn't come before you died, and somebody were to ask me to preach your funeral. I think I'll have to say no, because I don't think I could get through it. To know that you intended to be a Christian someday, but you just put it off. You believed the gospel, you knew the gospel, and you planned to obey it, but you didn't. And then I'm looking at you in the casket, and I know that you're not going to heaven. And then I look at your parents and your friends and your neighbors, and what am I going to tell them that's of consolation? I can't tell them that you're going to heaven. I'll be a liar and jeopardize my own soul if I do that. What is there in the world that I could say? What would a man stand up and say before an audience of friends and neighbors of someone who intended to be a Christian? You know, I've preached the sermon, or at least spoken a eulogy, for a couple of people who were not Christians, and they were far from it. And I just talked about some of the interesting little things they did in life. I didn't even try to speak of their eternal destiny. But if I knew you intended to be a Christian, I just don't think there's anything that I could get to come out of my mouth on that day when we put you to rest. To those of you who are already Christians, why aren't you teaching the lost? Why am I not teaching the lost more than I am? Sometimes we answer again, I don't know enough. Kind of like Moses, I can't speak well. Well, if you don't think you know enough, take somebody along with you that knows a little bit more. And then you'll learn as you go along. I'm not a teacher. Oh, yes, you are. Every one of us teaches something or the other, whether we know it or not. Sometimes we teach the wrong thing. Sometimes we leave the wrong influence. But every one of us teaches. If what you mean by that is I have a hard time organizing things into a way to present it, well, again, take somebody along with you to help you till you learn how to do that. Or if you answer, I'm doing just as much as anyone else here is doing, well, I might buy that as the truth. But can you imagine standing before the throne of God, being a baptized child of God and an heir of God, and God says to you, why, with all those people around you that didn't know the gospel, you didn't even bother to tell them anything? What would you answer? Lord, I did just as much as anybody else did. You think that'll be sufficient? Do you think that excuse will be enough? Do I think that excuse will be enough? Romans 14 and verse 12 says, so then every one of us shall give an account of himself to God. We're not going to be accountable for other people, and we're not going to be able to use other people for excuses. God didn't accept it when Saul did it. He didn't accept it when Adam did it. And he won't accept it if you or I do it. We're accountable for ourselves. And if we know the gospel and we believe the gospel, we have to obey it or we will give an account. Imagine that judgment scene one more time. I think perhaps if there's anything that'll break down excuses, it'll be trying to imagine ourselves before the judgment seat of God, with the Son of God and His hands pierced and His side pierced sitting alongside Him as evidence of God's love and God's desire for our benefit. To try to imagine any excuse that you or I have ever made being able to even come forth out of our mouth in that day. Evaluate your excuses now so that you don't have to then. Let's prioritize what's important. And if we don't have anything left in this world that we can call our own, if we walk the earth like Jesus did without even a pillow to call His own, and we inherit heaven, is that not more than a fair trade? And please, don't sell heaven for anything that seems important right now. Don't sell it. Esau sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. Will we sell our home in heaven for a television program or a young lady or a young man that we're interested in, or a nice house or a position or even a car? Let's not do that. Let's not make excuses, because God loved us so much that He gave His Son to give us heaven. If you're here today and you've not obeyed the gospel, you have the opportunity this morning. And we beg and we plead with you to consider obedience today while we stand and sing.